From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews from our archive with musicians who have played significant parts in the history of jazz. On today's edition, we hear from three musicians who played with Charlie Parker. Jay McShann led the Kansas City big band that launched Parker's career. We're listening to that band now. Red Rodney replaced Miles Davis in Parker's band. Max Roach played with Parker on groundbreaking bebop sessions. We'll also hear from singer Abby Lincoln. Early in her career, she and Max Roach recorded music inspired by the civil rights and black pride movements. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Seven people are dead after a shooting at an internet software company just north of Boston. Mitch Wertlieb reports from member station WBUR.
Massachusetts State Police say they have no prior criminal record for Michael McDermott, the 42-year-old employee of Edgewater Technology in Wakefield, who allegedly opened fire shortly after noon inside the company's headquarters, killing seven of his co-workers. McDermott was armed with an AK-47, a semi-automatic handgun, and a shotgun. He was subdued by Wakefield police when he was found sitting on the floor in the lobby of the building following the shooting. He faces arraignment Wednesday on seven counts of murder. Police say the shooting was work-related but would not elaborate. Officials at Edgewater say no layoffs were planned at the company. For NPR News, I'm Mitch Wertlieb in Boston.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders are expected to announce tomorrow whether they'll accept President Clinton's proposals for resuming the peace process. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak is set to convene his security cabinet tomorrow to discuss the proposals. The Reuters news agency quotes Palestinian officials as saying Yasser Arafat will send a non-committal letter to President Clinton outlining reservations about the ideas. After nearly 20 hours, Russian space officials have regained contact with the unmanned space station Mir, but not before raising fears that the 140-ton spacecraft could spin out of control and crash to Earth. Craig Nelson reports from Moscow.
Last month, the Russian government decided to ditch the crumbling 15-year-old Mir into the Pacific Ocean in late February. But those plans for a controlled crash were thrown into doubt late yesterday when Russian ground controllers lost radio contact with the orbiter. Before restoring communications with the Mir today, space agency officials considered sending a rescue mission into space to regain control of the spacecraft and prevent it from tumbling unguided to Earth. And the head of Russia's space agency said a crew of two cosmonauts was preparing to blast off if necessary. The nearly day-long loss of radio contact was just the latest mishap for Mir, once the crown jewel of Russia's space program. In 1997, a fire broke out on board the orbiter and it collided with a cargo ship. Since then, it has been beset by breakdowns and computer glitches. For NPR News, I'm Craig Nelson in Moscow.
A Russian court has reportedly dismissed fraud charges against wealthy media owner Vladimir Gusinsky. The Itar Tass news agency said the court found that the Russian government's fraud case against Gusinsky had no merit. Gusinsky is being held under house arrest in Spain while the Spanish courts decide whether to extradite him to Russia. Gusinsky denied any wrongdoing, saying he was a victim of political persecution because his newspapers and other media properties openly criticized the Russian government. The Dow Industrials gained 57 points today. This is NPR News. Firefighters in Central Florida say they're close to containing a 2,600-acre brush fire. A spokesman for the State Division of Forestry says the fire is now 95% contained. Workers have been fighting the fire for 4 days now. It's about 40 miles southwest of Orlando. Officials think the fire was probably started by sparks or hot exhaust from an all-terrain vehicle. New research shows that children who skip vaccinations are much more likely to get some preventable diseases. The research appears in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
In order to attend school, children generally need vaccinations against diseases including measles and pertussis, also known as whooping cough. But children in most states can avoid vaccination if their parents object on religious grounds. And 15 states allow exemptions when parents have philosophical objections. Government researchers wanted to know whether exempt children were more likely to get sick, so they studied outbreaks of measles and whooping cough among children in Colorado from 1987 to 1998. Only a tiny fraction of the children skipped vaccination, but those who did were at much higher risk. The researchers found that exempt children were 22 times more likely to get measles and about 6 times more likely to get pertussis. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
Once again, Tiger Woods has been chosen as the Male Athlete of the Year. Woods won the Associated Press Award for the third time, bringing him even with basketball star Michael Jordan. The winner is chosen by sports writers across the nation. Woods got the award after winning 9 golf tournaments this year. Second place in the voting went to bicycle racer Lance Armstrong. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, the recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal for the Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air. Throughout the week, we're featuring interviews from our archives with musicians who played significant parts in the history of jazz. There will be much more on the history of jazz next month on public television as Ken Burns presents his 10-part series, Jazz. We begin our series with Jay McShann, the last of the great Kansas City pianists and bandleaders. McShann grew up in Oklahoma and came to Kansas City in 1937 when it was the center of boogie-woogie, blues, and swing. In Kansas City, he assembled his big band, which became legendary because it featured the young Charlie Parker. The 70s brought a resurgence of interest in McShann, and since then he's made many solo and small group recordings. In 1987, McShann came to the Fresh Air studio and joined us at the piano. Jay McShann, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Terry, and it's a pleasure to be here.
If I may, can I make a request for the opening? Could you open with one of the songs that you wrote and that is named after you, Hootie Blues?
Be glad to. So long, but I had a little break, you see. Well, I'm doing all right. Well, I found a little Cupid doll. Well, I'm doing all right. Well, I found a little Cupid doll. Well, she lives 3 flights out, and she sends me with a smile. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Now ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. Yes, and a beggar too. Well, she calls me her lover. Yes, and a beggar too. Now ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. Ain't you.
That sounds absolutely terrific. My guest is Jay McShann at the piano. Can we go back to around the period when that tune was written, back to the 1930s when you came to Kansas City and started putting your big band together? Kansas City was a real mecca for jazz then. What were your first impressions when you got there?
Well, my first impression was I was excited and seeing all this happening and guys like Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, playing all the boogie-woogie, Joe Turner singing blues right off the top of his head, you know, make up words as he'd go along. And all these musicians are playing all this swing music, you know, and musicians from north, east, south, and west, and it was excitable. It was exciting.
What would you do to go recruit musicians? Where would you go to hear who the best musicians were?
Well, the way I did, I even went up to Omaha. And at that time, Nat Towles had one of the finest bands in the country. And I went up to listen to some of his musicians play. And when I left Omaha, I left there with about four of them.
Was that considered bad form to steal musicians from somebody else's band?
Well, no, it's not bad form as long as, you know, if they owe the band leader, then you give them the money to pay the band leader and bring them on. Really, it's nice, much nicer for them to give a notice, you know, but, you know, guys do things like that.
Probably the greatest discovery you made was finding Charlie Parker and getting him into your band. How did you decide to recruit him?
Well, I just happened to be passing through the streets one night, and they'd piped all the music out in Kansas City, and I heard this particular sound, and so I went in to see who it was, and then so we met and we talked, and he told me he'd been out of town because I thought I hadn't been in Kansas City very long, and I thought I'd met most of the musicians. So he said he'd been down in the Ozarks with George Lee's band, and it's hard to get musicians to go down there because it's so dead, you know, and like cats like to be around where the happenings is, you know. And so he said he wanted to do a little woodshedding, so he went down there with George's band.
It's such a big responsibility to hold a band together and to make sure all the players show up on time and that they're there when you're ready to travel and everything. Did you enjoy that part of it?
Well, that was quite a responsibility. But we made it easier, I guess, because, all the guys were young and crazy. And,
I'm
way,
sure.
I think the way you did it, since everybody was crazy, you did a lot of crazy delegating, you know. I like some guys, Gene Ramey, he would always look out for a couple of three of the guys. And I could count on Bob Maybane keeping a couple of three guys straight, you know. And I liked that, and it was no problem.
Jay McShann, can I ask you to play something else for us? How about a standard? This isn't the kind of thing you used to play back in the old days.
Okay. And when I growl too old to dream, your love will be in my heart. So kiss me, oh, kiss me, my sweet. And now let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, well, your love will be in my heart. Kiss me, my sweet, and now, oh, let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, your love will be in my heart. Well, your love will be in my heart. Well, your love will be in my heart.
A beautiful version of that. You didn't really sing too much, at least not on your records, when you had your big band, and the singers were Walter Brown, Big Joe Turner, Al Hibbler sometimes sang with you. How come you never got to sing yourself very much? Or maybe you did in concerts, which I wasn't around for.
No, I didn't. I didn't do any singing. In fact, I didn't do any singing at all. And I always felt that, you know, with the big band, you always, you wanted to serve good singers.
Wait a minute. You are implying that you're not a good singer.
But then after the war, you know, then I couldn't afford the good singers. And so I had to, you know, people would come up and ask for tunes. And they said, well, we want somebody to sing it. And so then I had to sing it, you know, so that's why I started.
Jay McShann recorded in 1987. His latest CD is called Forget Your Troubles. Coming up, Red Rodney talks about playing with Charlie Parker. This is Fresh Air. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air.
Dizzy took me up to New York one Sunday, sat me in the middle of the Three Deuces and to hear his band, and I heard Charlie Parker. It was like a religious experience. I was completely overwhelmed. I remember leaving that place 4 o'clock in the morning and walking around like I didn't know what to do, where to go, how to think, but I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's how powerful that affected me.
That was trumpeter Red Rodney in 1949. After playing in the bands of Claude Thornhill, Gene Krupa, and Woody Herman, Rodney ended up in the place just about every young musician then wanted to be, Charlie Parker's band. Parker hired Rodney to replace Miles Davis. Rodney left the band after a couple of years, and his career floundered in part due to a drug habit. He made a comeback in the 70s and played until his death in 1994. One of the celebrated stories in jazz lore is a story that was also recounted in the movie Bird, and that's the story of how during one of your tours through the South with Charlie Parker, he knew that an integrated band wouldn't go over well in the segregated South, that there were places you wouldn't be allowed to play. So he had the band advertised as Charlie Parker with albino red, so you were passed off as a black albino. This is a true story, right?
Yes, it is. We didn't fool anybody.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was very nice, and he had me sing a blues, and like the kid in the movie did. I think I sang better than that, though.
So. Is the story true that you ended up moving to a white hotel, and Parker said, I'll come with you, you could call me your valet?
Yeah, and they didn't show that in the movie. They should have, because that was hilarious. It would have been much better than the story they put in there in a hotel where he asked me to kick him in his rear end, and that never happened.
So tell me the valet story.
Well, after about a week or 10 days, we were in Atlanta, and I saw this big, beautiful hotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to go check in there. I'm going to take a bath. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this. He says, that's a good idea, and I can go with you as your valet. And I thought he was crazy, but he knew the South. If any white man at that time would register and say, John Jones and valet, they would not question it, and they'd give the valet a room along with him. And that's what happened. I remember him trying to send me downstairs to get cigarettes and newspaper. I said, no, you got to go down. You're the valet.
Let me play something that you recorded with Parker. Let's hear Parker's composition, Blues for Alice. And would you like to say anything about your memories of this recording session?
Well, that particular session, I was playing in the Jewish Alps, the Catskill Mountains. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call while I'm in the swimming pool. And he said, you better get down here quickly. Norman Granz is doing a record date with us. And told me the studio, and I said, I'll be right down. Well, it took three, four hours to get there. But I made it, and that was it. That was the Blues for Alice Swedish Knobs date. I think it's called Swedish Knobs, the album. At least originally it was.
Uh-huh. So this is Charlie Parker with Red Rodney on trumpet, John Lewis at the piano, Ray Brown on bass, Kenny Clark drums. I guess Red Rodney on trumpet, and that recording of Blues for Alice, recorded with Charlie Parker and Red Rodney. Well, Charlie Parker eventually hired you to replace Miles Davis. Did you feel prepared for that?
Not really. No, I told him, too. I told him I really wasn't ready for that. And he said, well, let me be the judge of that. He said, I know a good trumpet player when I hear one, and I think you are ready, and you'll be more ready once you come. And, of course, I grabbed it. I often say that was like going to college and graduate school, the 3.5 years I played with him.
Did Parker take you under his wing in addition to taking you into his band?
Well, I don't know about that. We were very friendly even before that. And, of course, we became more friendly when I was working for him. I was thrilled that a man like that could like me. I don't think I like myself very much. But I was really thrilled that he did, and I guess you might say he took me under his wing a little bit, yeah. Of course, when he saw that I was trying to emulate him, he protested violently.
Emulate him in which way?
Well, in his drug use. And, he got very, very upset, and of course he didn't like it at all.
Do you think one of the reasons why he hired you is that you weren't using?
I don't think he thought of that. No, I don't think so. But I know it would have been Well, it would have been more difficult if I were. I don't think he would have wanted to be involved with that. It was enough for him rather than to have somebody else messing around like that.
Did you start using heroin as a way to emulate him? Is that what it was about?
Yes, I was very immature, and I kept looking and looking and saying, oh, my God, if I cross that line, could I possibly play like that? Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and pretty soon you wind up with a little habit. You don't play any better. In fact, you don't really live up to your potential because you have to be healthy to play well. And there it is. It took me years to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. What did Parker do to try to discourage you? Anything? Discourage you from using?
Well, many things. He threatened to fire me every day. He let me know, in no uncertain terms, how terrible a thing it was and how he couldn't handle it, what made me think that I could. Well, it turned out that it killed our greatest, or one of our greatest musical giants at the age of 34. And the young kid that was there, who was able to get straight, is now 63 years old and fairly successful. So there's the paradox.
Red Rodney recorded in 1990. He died in 1994. It's Jazz Week on our show. We're featuring interviews from our archive with jazz musicians throughout the week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jazz Week continues with drummer Max Roach. He'll talk about his sessions with Charlie Parker. And we'll hear from singer Abby Lincoln. She recorded with Roach early in her career.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Max Roach is one of the inventors of modern jazz drumming. Together with Parker, Miles Davis, and Dizzy Gillespie, Roach helped formulate the language of bebop. In the mid-50s, Roach teamed up with trumpeter Clifford Brown to form what many jazz fans regarded as the quintessential bop group of the time. In the early 60s, Roach recorded the album We Insist, The Freedom Now Suite, some of the first jazz music inspired by the civil rights movement. Our interview was recorded in 1987. Here's Max Roach with Charlie Parker on the 1953 recording of Parker's tune, Confirmation. First drummers to play bebop, and you were one of the first people to figure out how to drum in the kind of fiery sessions that were being played. What were some of the challenges that that presented to you?
Well, when they played fast, they played very fast. It was a period where instrumental virtuosity was in our area, in the jazz area, was now prevailed. Because during the war, you know, we had an extra, the Second World War, we had an extra 20% cavalry taxes, very complex. Simply, to put it very simply, it was if an entrepreneur hired, he had to pay for, say, he had to pay a city tax, like in New York, he had to pay a state tax and a federal tax. And upon that, he had, on top of that, he had to pay a 20% government tax called entertainment tax if he had a singer, if he had public dancing or dancing on a stage or a comedian. This really heralded the demise of big bands during that time. This tax was just awful, you know. So the people who really got the jobs were the virtuoso instrumentalists. Everybody went home and practiced, and then that was the beginning of bebop, like the people who, so Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Shearing, the virtuoso players were the ones who people would come and sit down. Everybody began to sit and listen to the music rather than get up and dance to it. That was the beginning of it.
What rhythms had you been playing before, and what rhythms did you shift into playing when you started playing bop? Because you really had to invent new rhythms.
Yeah,
you
had to invent new style. I had help too. I had a lot of help. I had my my mentors were people like Big Sidney Catlett and Chick Webb and Joe Jones with the Count Basie Band, for folks who don't know. These were people who played with Louis Armstrong, and Sidney Catlett did, and later went with Benny Goodman. Sidney Catlett took Gene Krupa's place when Krupa started his own band. But all these folks, they were doing pretty much the same thing, but only in large band contexts. When you played in a small band, you had to do more. More was required of you because there were less people. It was like playing in a string quartet vis-a-vis a symphony orchestra. It's much more interesting for the individual player. Of course, an orchestra is interesting for the composer and the conductor and the soloist. But when you play in a smaller context, everybody has to do more to fill up the sound. So this was required of us, actually. I don't think we were aware of it, excepting that that very small band I worked in, the first one was Dizzy's. I worked in small bands, of course, all around the city at that time, but Dizzy was the one that his band with Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford and Bud Powell or Charles Mingus, that was all the virtuoso people got together. And that's, but we knew that everybody had to be kind of busy. So consequently, you heard more drums, you heard more piano, you heard more this and that and the other to fill it out. That's to put it very simply, of course.
Right. Well, to put it less simply, we'll hear some of what you were playing then. This is from the mid-1940s, and this is my guest, Max Roach, as recorded with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and we're going to hear Coco. Coco was recorded in 1945 with my guest Max Roach on drums and Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Does it bring back memories for you? Do you listen back to that
sure
much?
It sure does. It'd be Charlie Parker at that time, as well as Dizzy. The music was very, very fresh, and I guess you would equate it with what we hear today from people like Anthony Braxton. At least they treated us that way. We were the new breed on the scene, and they would say things, the critics would say, Dizzy sounds like he's playing with a mouthful of marbles, and Charlie Parker was playing scales from a saxophone book, just only scales, and Max Roach dropped bombs. I don't know, but it was interesting. Bud Powell had no left hand, and It was you know, we were criticized, but some of it was valid, I thought. You know, we had a long way to go.
Max Roach, recorded in 1987. Coming up, singer Abby Lincoln as our Jazz Week continues. This is Fresh Air. Abby Lincoln is one of the most emotionally gripping singers I know. Lincoln started her career in the 50s on the supper club circuit. She left that world after meeting the innovative drummer Max Roach. In 1957, they made the first in a series of records together, which featured Lincoln backed by such jazz luminaries as Sonny Rollins and Eric Dolphy. Lincoln's songs began to reflect her growing involvement in the civil rights and Black Pride movements. Since 1990, she's recorded for Verve. From her latest album, Over the Years, this is her song, I'm Not Supposed to Know.
I'm not supposed to know you need me, how much you need to show that you don't care. I'm not supposed to know how close you follow or understand the meaning of the stare. How much you need to hold me close to kill me. How much you need to take my breath away. I know I'm not supposed to really love you, but still and all, I love you anyway.
I spoke to Abby Lincoln in 1993 and asked about the early part of her career when she was performing on the supper club circuit and had to look glamorous and wear evening gowns. One writer described you as being packaged as the Black Julie London. Do you think that that's appropriate?
No, they used to compare me to Lena Horne. At that time, everybody was trying to be beautiful as Lena Horne.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Eartha Kitt, who was supposed to be a kitten. And you were supposed to have a glamorous image. And there was Marilyn Monroe. It was Marilyn. I wore a dress that they said she wore in a film called The Girl Can't Help It.
It was a rock and roll film.
Yeah, it was a fluke, really. And for the first time, I was using my physical look for... to attract attention to me, and it was a claim to fame. And it wasn't anything that I'd ever done before, because we were taught not to do that anyway. It's vanity. And so it was brought to me. It wasn't anything I thought of to do on my own. You know, some guys who were, who were very appreciative and ambitious for a career for me and thought I could make a lot of money as a personality and as a singer, as long as I made peace with the fact that they said I couldn't sing.
Oh, they didn't like your singing?
They did. They told me I wasn't really a great singer at all. I just looked good, you know?
That's really funny.
It is. Now, but...
Right now.
Mm-hmm. But I suffered from it.
Well,
it caused some problems.
Did it make you insecure to have the people who were managing you think that you weren't very good at what you did?
Well, yes, it didn't help me any. I remember saying once to this beautiful man, he was a great songwriter and taught me a lot. And I said to him, you know, I have the feeling you people are robbing me of my individuality. He said to me, you don't have any individuality, but you will if you take direction. Well, he forgot who he was talking to, because he was one of the ones who told me that I could really think, and that he had all this admiration for me. But anyway, all of that is in the past. I wouldn't give up any of it because I learned how to be whatever it is I am now.
Did it affect your relationship with men to be the sexy kitten on stage?
Because they believe, men and women, we all believe what we see on the screen. And people thought I was this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I played that role. Why would they think anything else? So I went from there to this warrior woman. And that befuddled everybody, too. Because they thought, oh, why don't you shut up? I think I've had that said to me more than anything in the world over the years when I was younger. You talk too much. Shut up. You know, don't rock the boat. Even though they're miserable, people are miserable, they'll tell you this. But you're not supposed to say anything about it. So when I discovered that there was the world of the artist, it saved my life because I could strive to be individual and as best as I could be. I didn't have to have money. I didn't have to have anything except my life. And I went for that, and I'm glad I did.
How did you discover the world of the artist from the world of the supper club?
Max Roach had a lot to do with it. He wasn't the only artist I met, though, actually. There was Benny Carter, who I did my first album with, and Bob Russell, who named me Abby Lincoln, was a great artist and songwriter. But Max brought me to this music that they call jazz and introduced me to these great musicians and singers who I probably wouldn't have met, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. I didn't get a chance to meet Charlie Parker because he passed away before I got to New York City.
You said that when you discovered jazz in the world of the artist that you turned into a woman warrior.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you were like as the woman warrior then.
Well, the first thing I did, I just started to wear my hair natural. That was a crime in 1958. A black woman wasn't supposed to show that she had hair like she had. It was a disgrace to have this kind of hair that they call all these crazy names. So I just glorified my existence. And I said, this is me, and this is my beautiful self, you know? The beauticians thought I was going to ruin their business. They did. They said I was after their business. And a lot of people said things. And I started singing songs that were more social. I started writing songs, and I found songs that would express what was in my heart. Because, you know, Billie Holiday was like this. She didn't sing inane things. She sang about the life that she lived. She may have been masochistic and all these things, but she sang Strange Fruit. And God bless the child that's got his own. It's the same reason they remember Bessie Smith, because these were social singers. They weren't just... It wasn't self-aggrandizement, standing in front of people saying how great I am. But they were singing songs about the people's lives.
I want to play a recording that you made of a song very associated with Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And it's a very masochistic song, Don't Explain. But it's just such a, it's a beautiful song, nevertheless. You know.
Yes, forgiving.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful melody, and I love the way you sing it.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit before we hear it about the influence Billie Holiday had on you. I think you're a very different singer than she is, although I hear the influence that she's had on you. But tell me a little bit about that influence, and also if you knew her, if you met her.
I met her when I was about 23 in Honolulu, and she came to the bar where I was working. It was probably to get away from where she was working because the place was jammed with people. Anyway, she came to see me a couple of times, and I'd run to catch her show, and I saw her magic on the stage, this beautiful woman who would stand perfectly still with her hands like she was like a doll, and her eyes would slide from one side of the room to the other, and the room was perfectly still. And... I fell further in love with her. This was my... Because I was singing a lot of songs that she sang already from that I learned on the radio, from the radio. But Billie Holiday was always honest. She didn't bend a note to make her voice sound good. it was in conversation that she sang. And she was sincere and honest, and she never made a record for money. She never raped anybody's career. And to me, she's the greatest singer of her era. I'm not the only one who feels this.
So do you think what you learned from Billie Holiday wasn't how to phrase as much as it was that you should be yourself?
Yes. Yes.
Let's hear your recording of Don't Explain, back from 1957, from your album That's Him, your first jazz recording.
Hush now, don't explain. Just say you'll remain. I'm glad you're back. Don't explain. Hush now. Don't explain. You're my joy and pain. Skip that lipstick. Don't explain.
That's Abby Lincoln singing Don't Explain. You and Max Roach got married during the period that you were recording together.
Yes.
How did you like married life? And I'm wondering if your career ended up taking a back seat at all during
no,
your marriage.
No, he's a great artist and would never ask another artist to do that.
Uh-huh.
But marriage is the pitch. You know why?
Why?
Because I'm a polygamous woman. I don't want him to be everything to a man. And I don't want him trying being everything to me. He's got his mother. I want to know if he loves his mother first. I want to know if he loves his first wife, if he got along with her or if he gets along with her. I just don't like this approach to marriage, and I will never do it again. I don't want to be that to anybody. I don't want anybody coming into my bedroom as if it's theirs. I have to have my own space, and I expect him to have his own. If he doesn't know how to have his own space, I don't want him around me.
So never again.
No, not that style.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We'll hear more from singer Abby Lincoln after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with singer Abby Lincoln. On the liner notes of one of your early records, someone quotes Thelonious Monk as having said to you the first time he saw you sing, "I like the way you stand."
No, he never said anything like that to me. Thelonious Monk wouldn't say anything like that to anybody in the first place. He doesn't give a damn about the way you stand. Excuse me, Lord. Thelonious Monk said to me, after listening to the words that I had written to his song, Blue Monk, he said to me, he came to where I was and whispered in my ear, "Don't be so perfect." And I said to Max Roach, "You know what Thelonious said to me?" He said, "Don't be so perfect." What did he mean? And Roach said, "He means make a mistake." And I didn't know what either one of them were talking about.
So how do you interpret that now?
It means that you must reach for something. You have to reach for the sky. If you don't make it, at least you reached for it. So your voice cracked, but you reached for it. You don't play safe. It's not safe, Jones. You take a chance on making a mistake. That's what they meant. And I do. I've learned to sing like that. Because I'm the human being. And even if it doesn't work, it's not wrong. If I didn't achieve what I meant to, it's okay. It's all right, because, I mean, I tried for it. Yeah.
Well, I just saw you sing in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a great performance.
Thank you.
And I don't know, it seems like when I see you on stage that you really are feeling the material that you sing. You're not falling back on professionalism or show business or anything. You seem to really be reaching inside each time you perform.
That's true. It's the way of the music. Thelonious Monk would be drenched in perspiration and absolutely possessed. Nina Simone, Billie Holiday, and Charlie Parker, even though I didn't see him, but I hear it in his music. It's a possession. It's the muse. They talk about the muse. I'm possessed of a muse, and I belong to her, and she belongs to me. And as long as I sing and I am real and I do nothing to betray the trust, this is what I do. And it's a wonderful experience to come to the stage and to know that everything is all right.
It sounds like you think that if you betrayed the trust of your muse, that your muse would abandon you.
Yes, they do. They don't need anybody. They can sing whistle around the corner. They can babble in the brook. They don't need anybody. If you don't come real, they don't come and visit you. They come to visit sincerity and innocence and that one. You have to have this spirit yourself. To know that we are great people, and this is part of our life, this is part of our spirit, music. And to sing with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, the way they do in the churches. That's where Aretha Franklin came from, where they sing for the reverence of the gods that they choose to worship. I didn't come from the church, and I see God through my mother and my father and my relatives. And when I come to the stages with reverence for myself, for my life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Abby Lincoln, recorded in 1993. Our Jazz Week continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Kathy Wolf, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jazz Week continues with interviews from our archive with bandleader Woody Herman and the late saxophonist Stan Getz. Getz played with Herman early in his career. And we'll hear from singer Anita O'Day. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.